I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me at MACLA on South First Street in downtown San Jose for a captivating conversation with MACLA's executive director, Angie Hillstrup Alvarez, and Joey Reyes, curator of engagement and dialogue.
All my friends, the low rider. The low rider is a little higher.
Hi, my name is Angie Hillstrup Alvarez, and I'm the executive director here at MACLA, which stands for Movimiento de Arte y Cultura Latinoamericana de San Jose Incorporated, or roughly translated to Movement of Latin American Arts and Culture.
And this is right in the heart of downtown.
We're right in the middle of downtown San Jose's SOFA Arts and Culture District.
All right, and you're with somebody else here.
Joey Reyes, who's our curator of engagement and dialogue.
Give us a word picture where you're located in downtown San Jose, how somebody would find you.
So we're in the midst of downtown San Jose, on about three blocks south of San Jose Museum of Art. We're just north of the 280 freeway. In our visual arts programs, you'll find our gallery, which we have up to four exhibitions that we curate here. My colleague Joey is the curator of the shows. And it's really looking to connect San Jose artists to artists that are working in the Bay Area and nationwide. Really looking to say, like, what's contemporary art today from the Latino perspective? So that might be anything from Cuban-American artist Luis Gispert, who's based in Miami, to Melina Ramirez, who's a San Jose-based artist here. You'll find really a range of work, of medium. In our Black Box performance space, you'll find the best of the Latino diaspora from the Bay Area and beyond. One thing that sets MACLA apart from some of our peers is not only if you come to one of our South First Friday art walks, you'll see a great performance on the stage. The performers will also invite you to learn a new dance move. So
oh,
it's
wow.
Really fun.
Very cool.
And we also have a youth digital media program. So where teenagers learn how to create videos, how to record music, and really all of those 21st century skills about teamwork and collaboration and project management.
And do you have traditional Central and South American music?
Exactly. So you'll find artists. This past weekend, we had a group that is Afro-Peruvian was performing. You'll find Puerto Rican. You'll find Mexican-American, Cuban artists. So just the whole range of the broader Latino diaspora.
Love it. And so to attend a musical performance, when do they typically happen, and how much would it cost to attend, and size of the venue?
Our 100 Black Box Theater, which we call the Castellano Playhouse, named after the folks that have supported us over the years, Al and Carmen Castellano. The South First Friday performances are always free and open to the public, so you can just come in, and it's the first Friday of every month from about 8 o'clock to 11 o'clock. You can come in and see them.
And I imagine that sells out.
They do. We always have crowds, and the great thing is most of our performers put on three different sets, so you can come in, see a performance for about 30 minutes, learn a dance step, and then go on to somewhere else in the evening.
How cool.
We're also part of the National Performance Network. So just a few months ago, we had Las Cafeteras perform, which is a musical group out of L.A. And then this spring, we're going to have Rick Salinas of the group Culture Clash going to perform a piece written by Chris Franco called 57 Chevy. So it's a new theater piece that we commissioned with some of our peers.
How cool. Joey, tell us about your curation.
The current show that we have on display is Custom Lives Rasquatcha Renaissance, and it was really developed out of the conversation about 57 Chevy and looking at the idea of the car, the 57 Chevy. And so out of that, Custom Lives was put together, which will focus on customization.
Imply lowriders and the whole car culture.
And the subtext Rasquatcha Renaissance really speaks to that idea of lowrider culture, but it also speaks to, it's basically a term that was taken by Mexican Americans, and it's basically using your resources of what you have, and that may include cardboard, and kind of creating this vernacular language really based around the idea of what it constitutes to be Chicano or Mexican American living in the U.S. And it looks at popular culture and alternative culture, looking at how something like lowrider culture is now found all over the world. You know, it's found not only in different parts of Latin America, different parts of the U.S., but now it's also found in Asia, and how those cultural influences have then gone on to really be a part of popular culture.
So that lowrider culture going way back even in music, in popular music, has had a place.
Yes, definitely. You know, and I think here, Makla, we are a highly contemporary space. So we definitely are rooted in tradition, but we also are very much cognizant of new genres and new media.
I imagine this is a really revered and appreciated venue for the artists that are just trying to surface.
I agree. Makla, part of our mission is that we're also very much an incubation space. And so we support those new ideas, and that within itself is exciting.
Talk to us about engagement and then dialogue.
Engagement really is, you know, what we've been using as a strategy, and we've been thinking about how we have our community involved in these conversations that are developed around our programming. And it's really bringing in our community as partners much more.
As you're talking, I'm imagining school kids being your most vital new entry connection.
I think not only school kids, but our local community. We do a lot of outreach through our NPN residencies, our National Performance Network residencies, and there's what's called the Visual Artist Network residency. And out of that, we take artists into the community, whether that's schools, whether that's K-12, and we have them meet and really kind of facilitate conversations around the work and also micro performances. We've had some of the artists come in and conduct classes at San Jose State with the assistance of a professor. And it may be about the diaspora within Latin American music and exploring that as a way to talk about, different cultural histories.
And when we say Latin America, we're talking about all the way down to Tierra del Fuego.
Of course, Tierra del Fuego. You know, my wife is half Argentinian, so.
You know, we kind of get myopic a little bit,
yeah.
And we think of Guatemala,
yeah,
or Nicaragua, and yet there's this whole huge, almost a planet beyond Panama.
Yeah, of course, and I think that is an organization, that's why we use the subtext Pan Latino, which speaks to that larger diaspora.
Your primary mission is very much contemporary, cutting edge. What's happening now? Like you said, that incubation.
Exactly. We are definitely what is pertinent, what is the hot button issue that people are dealing with in our community right now.
Give us a word picture of a show that you have going now or that's coming up.
Right now, Custom Lives with Squatch and Renaissance, you're going to come into the space and you're going to see artists working with, you know, the remnants of Loretta culture. It's really like an archaeologist going in and mining this history. So you're going to come in, you're going to see rims that are in display as a sculpture.
So actually tangible objects the lowriders, vehicles,
and
might be a chrome bumper.
Of course, and then I think it's kind of turned on its head, mm-hmm, right? It's presented in a way that you wouldn't expect, and there's a subtext or a subcontent that these are cultural artifacts, right? And that they resonate and they hold history and they hold meaning, and cultural meaning also. You know, you have the work of a very well-known late Chicano artist by the name of Gilbert Magulujan. And to him, the representation of the vehicle is a stand-in for culture, and that the car is much more a vessel of culture and a representation of history.
And the car very much is art.
Of course.
Literally on the car.
Yes, definitely literally on the car.
Very, very cool. Going forward, what's in your stew pot right now? What are you visualizing?
I think for us, there's really been kind of finding this crossover between like popular culture and then bringing that much more into the conversations that we're having and using that as a strategy to, in many ways, engage people at the core. I think moving forward, we've seen a success with our music programming, and we would love to present a larger music series within, you know, the next upcoming year or so. And I think we're on a really strong trajectory in what we're doing. Programmatically, we've noticed that the response has been really high, and people are very invested and interested in what we're doing, but I think engagement is at the crux of that, and that allows us to really reach out much more deeply than our community. So we're here in the gallery looking at the work of Carlos Rolon. The piece that we have on display is called Chrome Lotus. It's 13 chrome-plated rims, and the interesting thing about this project, it's a remount of from an exhibition that originally happened in Texas a few years ago. But what we did here is we worked with an artist also in the exhibition by the name of Marcos Gaitan, who is a lowrider enthusiast, has a very well-known local lowrider car, and is also part of a car club called High Tone. So Marcos assisted us of going out to the lowrider community to really source these rims that we have on display. And this piece that you have here is a result of that. You know, the interesting thing about this piece, it was very much like a crowdsourcing model, but at the ground level. What was exciting is we went into new communities that, as a curator, often you don't find yourself going into. And I got to know a lot about rims. And, you know, it was a great experience that really brought us into these new communities much more deeply.
Talk rims for a moment. Yeah. What was fascinating that you learned?
So we were trying to locate what is called a 1,000-spoke rim. And it was particularly gold-plated. So gold-plated could come in single plate, double plate, or triple plate. I knew nothing about cars prior to this, and I knew nothing about rims prior to this. But apparently, the gold true spokes are hard to find because cars cannot use them on the road because there's been incidences of, you know, basically the wheels coming off. So we had to really embed ourselves within that lowrider community to see who knew who to then get these rims so we can have them on display. So it was a much deeper process than what you see on display right now.
So do you do head turns when you drive around now when you see a really cool rim?
Yeah. You know, the interesting thing about the linkage between this work is kind of playing off the idea of the ready-made, if you're thinking in an art historical reference by Marcel Duchamp. And it's looking at this rim as this, you know, object that has been designed, that has been carefully crafted, and there's aesthetic considerations in the making of this thing. It's about how it's read aesthetically. Mm-hmm. In many ways, you know, it's the same concerns that we have in fine art. And so, yes, I do turn my head to look at rims much more, and I actually considered getting some new rims for my car.
Awesome. My name is Angie Helstrup-Alvarez, Executive Director of MACLA. For more information about us, see MACLAARTE.org.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
My name is Joey Reyes. I'm the Curator of Engagement and Dialogue at MACLA.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Love it. Thanks again, you guys.
You're welcome. All right. Been a lot of fun.
I know.
Plans for the iconic Hotel De Anza in the heart of downtown San Jose were drawn up in 1929. The Roaring Twenties and the Jazz Age was in full swing, but little did anyone know at the time that when the classic Art Deco Hotel first opened its doors for business in February 1931, the Great Depression was at its worst, but the De Anza held its own and thrived on for decades as a premier destination for movers and shakers. And in its heyday, luminaries such as Eleanor Roosevelt, Cab Calloway, and Jack Dempsey checked in at the De Anza. The classic hotel with its timeless zigzag modern Art Deco motifs melded with classic Spanish colonial revival accents fell on rough times by the 1980s, and there was eventually talk of its demolition. But this elegant first lady of downtown San Jose survived, and today, following a massive multi-million-dollar renovation in 2015, the De Anza has resumed her place as an understated, classy place to stay, where its timeless Art Deco motifs live on. The De Anza is more than just a place to stay. It is the hotel's enchanting Headley Club, with its architectural hints of Julia Morgan's Hearst Castle, is where live jazz happens every week. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me at the Hotel De Anza for a visit with General Manager Isabel Matter and Director of Marketing Max Schultz as they share an insider's glimpse into the highlights of the legendary Hotel De Anza's history and highlights of its recently completed renovation.
Hello, my name is Isabel, and I am the general manager here at the Hotel De Anza.
And I'm Max Schultz. I'm the director of sales and marketing.
Right at the beginning of the Depression, this beautiful, classic, elegant, grand old dome of San Jose opens.
Brand new. First opening day was February 26, 1931, near as we can tell.
And when this hotel opened, it really was the place to stay.
Yes, definitely one of the luxury hotels in downtown San Jose.
And you were saying earlier it was the first hotel in San Jose proper with a swimming pool.
That's correct, yes. There used to be a swimming pool in the Palm Court, which is an outside-inside, wonderful, beautiful room adjacent to the hotel. And I know that when the hotel opened back in the time, it used to be the tallest building downtown San Jose.
And in the days, there was a live radio broadcast from here, and it really was the hub.
And it was the hotel where visiting dignitaries like Eleanor Roosevelt was introduced to San Jose civic people here in 1947.
Interesting. Yeah. Over the years, like a lot of city hotels, it lost its luster and then it got saved.
Yes, the late 80s, about 1988, we actually found some photos where the building, all the windows were boarded up and graffiti everywhere. The hotel was going to be demolished. And the preservationists were able to step in along with the redevelopment agency, and complete and total restoration was done.
Tell us about the reincarnation of the hotel.
Recently, we started a complete extensive renovation of the property. However, we really kept in mind the importance of staying true to its feel and keeping the Art Deco feel that it has. And that was very important to us. We've renovated all of the guest rooms and all of the public areas. If you see the hotel now, it is just really beautifully done, very much with the Art Deco style in mind.
Being right in the heart of San Jose, I imagine it's a great place for business people to stay. But also, I see it as being a great place for regular vacationers and traveler people.
That's what we'd like to think, too. Being so central to a lot of signature events in downtown San Jose, our annual jazz festival is one that comes to mind. This is a Jazz Age hotel. The main festival stage is two blocks away at Chavez Plaza, and that'll be in August.
Somebody said weekly live jazz here almost every night?
Wednesday through Saturday, live jazz in our Headley Club.
Is there a cover charge for that?
Never a cover charge.
That's pretty cool. And then the other thing that I thought was cool, you have an on-site restaurant that's very good and reasonably priced fair.
Yes, we have our own restaurant, which is called La Pastaya, which has been around forever. And we have wonderful Italian cuisine. And the restaurant has been known by the locals for many years now.
Let's talk about some of the secret little inner sanctums of this hotel that I thought were really cool. The Headley Club in the back, you'd never imagine that was...
Yes, Headley Club is a unique place in its style and look and feel, and it's a local's favorite. Again, we have great live jazz in Headley, and we have a wonderful group of loyal people that have been with us for many, many years and come and have lunch here every day, and we know each other by name, and we know what they like and what they don't like, and it's just a place to come and enjoy one another.
That sense of entry, it was like walking into a grand, comfortable living room. It didn't have that, you know, antithesis for that hard techno, hard-edged building.
Yeah, it's definitely not your typical hotel bar feeling in any sense. It feels more like a very large living room.
With shades of William Randolph Hearst.
And Hearst Castle, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, tell us about the ceilings. That's pretty cool.
The ceilings in the Headley Club are the restored original stenciling. Really, we did nothing on the renovation to that room with the most recent renovation. It stands on its own. It's so iconic and so beloved by the local patrons.
This is a doable kind of grand central starting point for downtown San Jose. A zillion things to do. The Tech Museum is a block or so away.
Block and a half away. Mm-hmm. And then just to the west of us is SAP Center for the Sharks and other entertainment. And that's two blocks. Museum of Art is another two blocks away.
It's walking distance to a lot of great places. We're right next to San Pedro Square, which offers a variety of restaurants and bars where you can enjoy some good food. And then the train station is just two blocks away as well.
For the savvy traveler, when's the best time to come? Because I know that you guys are inundated with business and Silicon Valley travelers during most of the week time. Value-driven time for those on a budget?
Fridays and Saturdays are king. Unlike a destination hotel in Santa Cruz, or weekdays are busy spots with corporate travel, weekends much more budget-friendly.
Hotel De Anza, heart and soul of downtown San Jose. I love it.
Thank you very much for visiting us.
For further information, website?
HotelDianza.com.
The quilt has been a part of the American fabric since colonial days, and the quilt remains synonymous with the pioneer women who crafted beautiful works of art out of necessity, and is one of the few luxuries of time for creative expression in their lives. In honor of the quilt and related fabrics and textures, the San Jose Museum of Quilts and Textiles celebrates its 39th year as America's first museum to focus specifically on quilts and textiles as an art form, and the museum showcases engaging works of art that appeal to millennials and grandparents alike. This is a not-to-be-missed destination in downtown San Jose to discover the preservation, promotion, and evolution of fiber art and the distinctive world of quilters and crafters. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a conversation with Nancy Bavor, the curator of collections and exhibitions, Amanda Rawson, manager of museum advancement, and Joan Phillips, executive director.
Nancy Bavor, San Jose Museum of Quilts and Textiles. I'm curator of collections and exhibitions here at the museum.
I'm Amanda Rawson. I am also here at San Jose Museum of Quilts and Textiles, and I am the manager of museum advancement.
And I'm Joan Phillips, and I'm the executive director.
This is new to me.
We are the oldest quilt museum in the country. There is one museum that's an older textile museum in Washington, D.C., but we are the first museum in the country to focus solely on quilts or primarily on quilts. And we were founded in 1977 by the Santa Clara Valley Quilt Association, and we'll celebrate our 40th anniversary in 2017.
Quilting was really under the radar, and it's only really in the last, 30, 20 years that it's come to its own.
Depends on who you ask about quilting being under the radar. I think for the women who made quilts in the 19th and 20th century, it wasn't under the radar. But because it was women's work and it was often for function, or people think it was for function, it did kind of fly under the radar. And it really came to public awareness when quilts began to be considered art. And one of the pivotal exhibitions was in 1971 at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York. And quilts were hung for the first time in an art museum as art. And even if they knew the makers, they didn't include it. The labels talked about, they talked about the quilts as if they were contemporary paintings, bold graphics, color, and a lot of them looked like what was going on in contemporary painting at the time. And so people started looking at quilts as not just a utilitarian object, but as an object of art, of great beauty. And that's when they began to come out of people's attics.
My name's Amanda, and I've actually been here for a little less than a year now, and I've fallen in love with this museum. A part of it is because I honestly didn't know how special it was until I really immersed myself into everything that is quilts and textiles. One of my own personal goals is to try to get everybody in my age group, millennial age group, to come in here and know that there's something really amazing happening in these galleries.
Is that happening? And do you have the aha moments?
Yeah, especially when I talk to friends and let them know that I'm here. And I share with them photos and encourage them to come into the museum. I've seen their faces surprised, and they tell me, I can't believe I haven't been in here before. Some people want to find out about programs that we're doing.
And talk about the programs for a moment, because I imagine you change them up.
Right now we have been doing a yarn tagging kind of programming throughout the past few months, where in front of our museum, we have yarn knitted around light posts and...
It was on our parking meter.
Yes, on the parking meter. And, you know, it's just like a fun way of showing art on the streets, not just in the mural format, which we also have here, you know, downtown.
So. That's funny. Well, at least they know where the yarn taggers live, huh?
Yeah, I suppose so.
pretty busted. Tell us a little bit more about what they would see and experience here. We're in one gallery space, and you have another that I haven't.
We have between 18 and 20 different exhibitions every year. We happen to have four separate exhibitions now. The one I just described here, Conversations, by two artists from Fresno. And in the two of the other galleries, we have an exhibition that was actually put together by a group called Studio Art Quilt Associates. And it was one of those organizations that was founded to support those art quilters that we talked about. And it's a group of 24 quilts that were selected by a juror, Carolyn Maslumi, who is also a quilt maker, artist, historian. And then the theme was Earth Stories, and they also proposed to celebrate a person or an organization that is doing something to improve the environment.
A real greater good component.
Something to say. I mean, these are quilts with messages, and some of them are really quite moving.
Give me an example of one that moved you and touched you the most.
It's hard to choose. One of them I think is important, and it's an organization that people may not know about. It's called Floating Island. It's in Montana, Floating Island International, and they take plastic milk bottles. They recycle them. They remove the fluorocarbons. They make a non-toxic plastic, and they create an island that's about, you know, 6 feet by 12 feet. It's a plastic island. And then they put plants in this island, and they float it where maybe a wetland has been destroyed. So they can restore wetlands that were destroyed by hurricanes, by rising sea level, just overnight. And these islands purify the water and the runoff. And
how would somebody find out more about that? That's pretty cool.
FloatingIslandInternational.com, I think, is their website.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. We need more of that.
We do need more of that.
Something to add to that also is that it represents artists internationally. I know that's something you were asking, but once you go into that gallery and you see the show, you'll see that there are artists from Japan and there are artists here from the United States, but also the Netherlands, Canada, and I think that's it's not just California artists, it's not just United States artists, but it's international artists that are coming here and we're exhibiting their work in our space.
And I imagine you have a local showcase in focus too, right?
We do. The gallery that we are in, we call it our community gallery, a fiber space, and groups of three or more artists can apply, common theme, the work has to be strong. But we have so much talent in Northern California.
Somebody that has not been here, how do they find you, and when is the best time to come?
Our website is sjquiltmuseum.org. We are open Wednesday, Thursday, and Fridays from 12 to 5, and Saturdays and Sundays from 11 to 5.
Thank you guys so much. What a pleasure.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you.
Yeah, and I'm glad we came here. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the San Jose Museum of Quilts and Textures in downtown San Jose, California. Thanks for joining us.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.